Before we begin, if you want to join our growing group of supporters and give $5, $10 or $20 a month to help make the show even better, you can sign up to the Harder Reports Patreon right now and get exclusive access to full, unedited interviews with guests. That's the Harder Reports Patreon at patreon.com/TheHarderReport. And now, today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Harder Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by Jonathan Herzog, who's running for Congress in New York's 10th Congressional District. Jonathan Herzog, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. So fun to be here.
You've decided to run for office in New York's 10th Congressional District against Democratic incumbent Representative Jerry Nadler. You've not made it easy for yourself. You picked a very well-established name in Congress. You know, Jerry Nadler is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He's been in Congress since 1992. You obviously have these progressive ideals that you're pushing. Why do you think Jerry Nadler isn't this progressive politician compared to the people who live in the district you want to represent?
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much. And fundamentally, it doesn't really have much to do with the incumbent. So as you said, I'm Jonathan Herzog. I'm an organizer, I'm an educator, an advocate for universal basic income, endorsed by Andrew Yang. Proud gay son of first-generation immigrants, born on the west side of New York. And the 10th District covers the west side of Manhattan and South Brooklyn. And right now, as you know, we're in the midst of a global pandemic and the fourth industrial revolution, where just today we saw 26 million Americans are unemployed, nearly 50,000 are dead. Congress is still on recess. More than a million New Yorkers are unemployed. More than 10,000 have died in New York City alone. And Congress is still on recess. So the reason I'm running is that we need a representative who understands the structural crises we're facing and has a clear vision to tackle them. We need to wake up. Hate crimes in New York last year alone doubled. It's not about Trump. It's about what comes next.
One of the points you touched on there, really crucial point, which is that more than 26 million Americans have lost their jobs. We've seen the number of people who died from coronavirus in America. It's rising at a rapid and scary rate on a daily basis, and cities like New York have been particularly affected by this crisis. But Congress, as you note, is still on recess. Is Congress here just failing in its basic duty to protect Americans? And if so, why?
Tragically, in part, it seems to be, at least in part, a matter of failing to understand and utilize technology. So, for example, the New York City Council was able to hold their meetings and sessions over Zoom, but Congress has, and the Democratic leadership has decided they're not able to, or don't know how, or refuse to. So they continue to extend their recess, in part, again, due to the reluctance to use technology as a tool to be able to serve and to legislate, even as we're self-quarantining in our own homes.
This is something that is a big part of the issues that exist in Congress as well. When we look at the coronavirus outbreak, it's shone an even brighter spotlight on the issue of universal health care, expanding Medicare to cover all Americans, something you support. How important, particularly right now, and knowing that pandemics like this will likely affect us going forward in the future, to ensure every American has access to affordable health care?
It's incredibly important. If there were ever a clearer light to be shown on the absurd reality of the path-dependent history of tying health care to employment, when millions and millions of people are being furloughed or laid off, it's now. It's just revealing the underlying weaknesses and institutional design flaws of our system and uniquely of our system. But I'll say even further, the notion of also linking income to employment is coming more and more into question. And this was before COVID, before the pandemic in New York's 10th district. Again, this is for context, the world's financial capital, one of the highest median incomes, nearly two thirds of people work in some sort of financial services industry, but still here, one in six people live in poverty. Still here, before the pandemic, one in five storefronts were closing. Still here, before the pandemic, there were nearly 5,000 homeless youth right here in the city. And so the reality is COVID is an accelerant, and it also reveals the underlying structural failures, both of tying healthcare to employment, as you so clearly suggest, but also of even tying basic income, the ability to meet one's basic needs and survive to employment as well.
That issue of tying healthcare to employment has seen millions and millions of Americans now lose healthcare, lose the access. Would you seek to pass a law then that permanently ends that connection? So not only gives everyone access to affordable healthcare through Medicare for All and what's there, but prevents any situation arising again where your healthcare, even if, say, Republicans do what they've done to the affordable healthcare, they chip away, they take a bit here, but pass a separate law that ensures that healthcare can't be tied directly to employment. They are two separate entities in a person's life.
So I certainly agree we have to guarantee quality, affordable healthcare to all Americans as a right of citizenship. The reality of the very complex bureaucratic Byzantine healthcare and insurance system we have is that we have hundreds of thousands of Americans themselves who even work in just the insurance industry itself. So if we were to evaporate a whole cloth, even if that were possible overnight, that would mean nearly 750,000 people out of work. And so when it comes to healthcare, I think we need to move towards very, very quickly and deliberately towards Medicare for All. But one of the things we can do overnight, and we actually have the capacity to do, as we're seeing now in some sense with this stimulus, although it has many limitations, is we can send cash to people directly to their hands. And then they can use it in the way that they need and see best fit for their own lives. So I completely agree. We need to 100% move towards decoupling, delinking healthcare from employment. But the thing that we can literally do overnight is send millions of checks to millions of people.
And you've called on your opponent, Representative Jerry Nadler, to, quote, help save the New York economy and thousands of lives by ensuring a $2,000 a month basic income is part of the next COVID-19 stimulus. But beyond that, this would essentially be a trial model of the universal basic income policy that's been proposed by numerous politicians now, most notably Andrew Yang, who you worked on his campaign. When looking at going beyond this current crisis and boosting the economy going forward, could you tell us a bit about the freedom dividends universal basic income proposal that you're putting forward here?
Yes, absolutely. So as you put so well, the freedom dividend, the universal basic income, very simply is, during the COVID pandemic, a universal direct cash payment of $2,000 per month to every American. And after the COVID pandemic, in perpetuity, $1,000 per month for every American adult and $500 per month for every child. And the primary way we finance this, we pay for it in perpetuity, is a value-added tax, which almost every industrialized economy already has, and the United States doesn't have. And so we have a massive revenue problem because we have giant tech corporations like the Amazons, Googles, Netflixes, Ubers of the world that pay next to zero or zero in federal taxes, in part because our tax system isn't great at harvesting the gains from new technologies like artificial intelligence and software. It is good at taxing the gains from human labor. But as we're seeing now, more and more firms are even accelerating their already tendency towards automating entire sectors of the economy. And so the universal basic income doesn't solve every problem, but it makes every problem easier to solve. And you don't even have to look abroad at examples of how it can work in practice. You can look at Alaska, where for 40 years, they've had a universal petroleum dividend, where every citizen in Alaska gets around $1,000 a year, no questions asked. And this is in a deep red, conservative Republican state passed under a Republican governor, because they found a large supply of natural petroleum reserves. And essentially, the question became, well, should the funds go to the government or to you, the people? And the Alaskan people decided it should go directly to them. And the data on the just the effects on mental health, nutrition, and health outcomes, childhood education, high school graduation rates, but even rates of entrepreneurship, trust in communities, both in the Alaska example and also in all of the pilot and test cases run around the world, it just shows it's one of the most direct and impactful ways. And there was one study that showed just alleviating gross poverty on its own would increase GDP by nearly $700 billion every year. So the question really is, how can we afford to not have a universal basic income? But again, put quite simply, it is just direct cash transfers to American citizens on a monthly recurring basis.
One of the important reasons that it's been proposed, and you've touched on this through the interview here, is that automation has taken away, so far, millions of jobs in the manufacturing industry. You only need to look at places like Michigan, or specifically Detroit, or other manufacturing states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, who've been particularly hit by automation and the loss of jobs in their manufacturing sector. It's been estimated that one in three Americans will likely permanently lose their job to new technology over the next decade. And part of the implementation of this freedom dividend is to help Americans out there to alleviate the financial impact of this. But obviously, we'll need to see Congress going further here, or too many Americans will just simply be out of work, be unable to get back into the job sector. So alongside this freedom dividend, what else would you like to see being done to prepare Americans for that future?
As you suggest, this is just a floor. This is just a floor below which no one should fall. And then it's just the foundation upon which we have to keep building and keep moving forward upon. So as we talked about, we need universal healthcare, expanding Medicare for all, so that healthcare is a right of citizenship, not tied to employment. Otherwise, people experience job lock, are afraid and often unable to go start businesses because they're afraid of losing their healthcare that was tied to their employment. We need publicly financed elections and rate choice voting. And one of the proposals is called Democracy Dollars. And it's where every citizen gets $100 in a voucher every single year to allocate to a federal candidate of their choosing. And what this does is it lets people actually decide who their representatives should be, as opposed to the other way around. So with Democracy Dollars, we can actually have publicly financed elections. So you don't have representatives who, on average now, spend 30 to 70% of their time just calling the wealthiest folks to fundraise for their reelection campaigns. And it goes, I mean, there's the list goes on and on and on. But here in the United States, we don't even have a data bill of rights. And again, we have a lot to learn from you across the pond in establishing basic fundamental data property rights and data protections. And this is so fundamental in an era where data really is the new oil, and where firms have been harvesting and selling and reselling our data to trillions of dollars in value, and we're seeing next to nothing of that. And this is having really significant effects on the health of our democracy, as we all are stuck even further into our information silos, where firms are able to micro-target. And we saw this so clearly with the Cambridge Analytica scandal in the 2016 election, with grave effects. But we're seeing a crisis at an even larger scale with Clearview AI and the abuse and misuse of facial recognition technology without our consent, without our knowing, and pulling in data from all sorts of places that we would never have imagined. So really the vanguard of civil liberties protection and fundamental freedoms is at the protection and security of our data rights. So that just kind of scratches the surface of some of the urgent policies we have to move towards. But the general thesis is we're facing 21st century problems, and we need 21st century solutions that are calibrated and designed to tackle those problems specifically and head on. Because as Yuval Harari recently said, in this era, whoever controls the algorithms is the real government.
When it comes to data rights in America, there's no single data protection legislation in the United States. There's just hundreds of federal, state-level laws that are in place. And while there are some agencies that are involved in data protection, there's no one agency that is responsible for truly looking at and addressing and dealing with the issues that exist when it comes to data rights. Do you think that's an issue that really needs to be tackled head on here, that it's time for an agency to take on data protection, data rights, ensuring that companies don't misuse data? Because we've seen various internet, social media, digital companies being accused of or deliberately misusing clients' data with and without the knowledge of the consumer and customer themselves. So do you think that's something that Congress needs to be looking at implementing?
100%. We most definitely need a Department of Technology as a federal agency. In fact, nearly 25 years ago, they got rid of the committee that advises Congress on technology. They just got rid of it. They stopped funding it. So this is really a fundamental problem where the federal government is and has been asleep at the switch right at the critical moment when the evolution and advancements in digital technology, in artificial intelligence, in machine learning, in the internet really came online. So 100%, but it goes even beyond that, where we don't even have fundamental principles of data property and data protection in legislation. So it's not even not just having a centralized body to work with technologists in monitoring and regulating. It's just that we don't even have the legislation in place to enforce.
If people take a look at your photograph, they'll notice that you're an incredibly young individual running for Congress compared to those compared to those people that are already in Congress, and certainly compared to the Democratic incumbent you're seeking to unseat here. When you look at issues like social media, like digital, like technology, do you think that's one of the big issues here? That Congress is just filled with individuals now who do not fundamentally understand the changes that are impacting Americans in the 21st century, that they aren't up to date with developments in digital technology or even manufacturing technology, that we need fresh faces who really and truly understand what's happening?
I think one of the clearest tests of this, and I'll just say self-reflectively, I was recently, trained and kind of introduced into the world of TikTok. And if you think our generation has difficulty catching up and being fully versed in the advancements in digital technology and software, then, I mean, to your point, just imagine what 3, 4, 5, 6 decades when many folks in Congress may not even have smartphones or apps on their smartphones or use email. Use email. So I certainly think that technology and the way it's fundamentally changed our lives, and as you put so well, restructured the entire base of our economy, right? So our economy shifted from an agrarian to industrialized, mechanized system of production. And that sort of now century approach to production has permeated our education system, permeated healthcare, permeated our fundamental mindset around public and common goods. And traditionally, in decades past, the architecture of the Democratic Party was that this unionized labor industrial base was the core of their voting support. So just try to imagine, you know, when all of your incentives, again, in re-election, in just, again, structuring and financing an entire party apparatus is rooted in this base that is tragically, but the reality is, just disappearing and disappearing. And this is what Andrew Yang's campaign was calling out, is that for the decade and a half leading up to the election of Trump, we had decimated millions of these manufacturing jobs in particular in those key swing states you mentioned. And if you look at the district data, one of the tightest correlations he found was the automation of a factory or of a manufacturing center, and then that community just being decimated. The schools closing, the malls shuttering, and then people literally drinking themselves and killing themselves to the point where American life expectancy, I mean, this is shocking. American life expectancy before COVID, before Trump, was declining for 3 years consistently. Unheard of, unprecedented in an advanced industrialized economy, and for the first time in nearly a century since the Spanish flu. This was all before the COVID pandemic. So to your point, technology is really so central to all parts of both the macroeconomy and the way it affects our healthcare, education, and public policy.
When looking at one of the most concerning areas that leads to loss of life in America, it's gun violence. We see there are mass shootings on a monthly basis in America. The number of gun violence incidents is happening on a daily basis. We've seen in an average year in New York, 852 people die by gun violence. That's a rate of 4.1 deaths per 100,000 people. It's a concerning situation that has arisen. How do we make sure that Americans are safe out there?
Yeah, it's an incredible and tragic question. I also recently saw, again, in just a tragic and ironic manner, is that we haven't had a school shooting in the United States recently, or a mass school shooting on the scale that we were so accustomed to, in part due to the massive shutdowns due to COVID. But to your question, we certainly need common sense gun legislation, like overturning the massive loopholes and the red flag laws and a perpetual gun, voluntary gun buyback. But I think one of the core messages of this movement in particular is looking at some of the root causes and some of the kind of upstream sources of violence, because one of the most common deaths due to gun violence is actually suicide. And if you look a little bit upstream, part of this is the stranglehold the NRA has over our legislature and our federal representatives. And so again, going back to an idea like democracy dollars, like publicly financed elections, it's really not an abstraction, because whether it's gun safety legislation, which the majority of Americans support common safety gun legislation, or climate change, which again, the majority of Americans support taking immediate action towards the existential or staving off the and trying to mitigate the worst effects of this existential crisis, or Medicare for all and universal healthcare, which the majority of Americans support. Part of the big gulf between the vast majority of American preferences and the actual actions of the legislature is campaign financing and where the campaign coffers are tied to. Because if you're spending, again, on average, half of your time just being responsive to the corporate PACs and organizations and donors in your district, and then not to mention redistricting so that you can choose which voters you represent, this fundamentally warps your incentives around which policies you should enact. And tragically, again, this has many downstream effects, like the terrible stranglehold of the NRA. And we see this in just in terms of real human costs.
One of the points that you made earlier in this interview, one of the points that you touched on, is the issue around LGBT rights in America and the situation around LGBT youth in particular. And you touched on in the gun violence conversation a little bit about the issue of suicide. When you look at the LGBT community, suicide is a massive issue in part because of the way that LGBT individuals are treated. In 2018, the FBI released their hate crime statistics, and these were submitted by over 16,000 law enforcement agencies. 16.7% of hate crime incidents were directed at individuals because of their sexual orientation. When we're seeing people out there who are not just under threat from people who are targeting them because of their sexual orientation, but are also under threat because of the actions of the government targeting individuals because of their sexual orientation, what can be done to stop LGBT individuals feeling like they're under so much pressure, under so much constant attacks by people? Because it does cost lives here, these actions, and politicians seem to ignore the human cost of their actions sometimes, but it is a truly heartbreaking situation that clearly needs to be addressed.
I so appreciate this question, in part because it is so personal. I know all too well that the promise of it gets better for us is fundamentally hollow without the promise of financial security in the case your family or your community or your government rejects you for who you are. And we, like, the LGBT community is tragically overrepresented among foster children, the homeless, the poor, the food insecure. One in five LGBT Americans lives in poverty today. We're kicked out by parents at a higher rate than the general population. One in seven trans people, one in three trans people of color live in severe poverty. And fundamentally, we just have to say once and for all that poverty is an absence of cash, not character. And I think the single most transformative way for the government, for us, to improve our lives, to improve the lives of the LGBT community in particular, is to send us a check for $1,000 every month and let us spend it in whatever manner will benefit us the most. And again, this is the fundamental message that was first championed by Martin Luther King. And to your point about the rise in hate crimes and in attacks on folks, that is really what made me feel like I had to run. I didn't really set out to run for Congress. If you need any evidence, you can follow me on Instagram. But I reached out to our politicians and leaders to sound the alarm, and to sound the alarm really on what you specifically just spoke to, which is, I looked at the data on unemployment in Germany between 1920 and 1932, and the Nazi vote share. And at the precipice of the Great Depression, you can see in 1928, when we hit this kind of knee of the curve, there is a near one-to-one correlation with the increase in percentage of German unemployment and the increase in Nazi vote share in the Reichstag. And so one of the fundamental principles that is historically omnipresent is that societies in scarcity, societies under currency, undergoing massive currency devaluation and hyperinflation, they go haywire and they look for scapegoats. That is the first thing they do, because we as humans are fundamentally narrative seeking and social creatures. And we need a story. We need a story to tell about why there's so much suffering in the world. And to your point, historically, consistently, two of the groups that have been consistently the brunt of that narrative have been Jews and gays. And it really struck me when I was reading again some of this history more recently, and Theodore Wolfe in 1933 said, "It is a hopeless misjudgment to think that one could force a dictatorial regime upon the German nation. The diversity of the German people calls for democracy." This is Theodore Wolfe in a German newspaper in 1933. Democracy within itself bring dictatorship. So I agree with you. There is no inevitability. There is no teleology. There are people, ideas, and then people acting upon those ideas. And when our societies and economies and institutions fall apart, we tend to scapegoat. And so it's on us to preempt and prevent this collapse in the first place.
One of the solutions to the issues that exist when it comes to minorities in America and across the world is that the importance of representation. When young LGBT individuals, when ethnic minorities are growing up, when immigrants are growing up, seeing individuals like them in positions of power, on TV, in Congress, in business, etc., is an incredibly important part of their development, not just because those individuals in those positions of power are able to affect change that addresses the needs of those communities, but because personally they're able to look up to them and say, I'm able to one day be that individual. I'm equal to others in positions like that. One criticism that you faced from individuals on social media I've seen is that Representative Jerry Nadler, he has been quite supportive of the LGBT community. However, he himself is not a member of the LGBT community. Do you think having individuals like yourself there who understand what those communities have been through, you've talked about how you're LGBT, how you're Jewish, understand what those groups need and the policies that they need put in place is incredibly important? And is that part of the motivation behind your run for office?
It certainly is rooted in my experience and colors my worldview and perspective. But when I go out and talk to people, or now not really go out, but, you know, talk to people over Zoom and, you know, and calls and the like, I ask people to support us and the movement, not because of who I am, but because of the specific policies, the specific detailed policies that we're fighting for. Now, I fundamentally believe this would be the most transformative set of policies to empower not just the LGBT community, but everyone, everyone in the 10th District and everyone really here in the United States to move us all forward. I think it's a vision that everyone can see themselves in and see themselves benefiting from. That's part of the message and the power of the universality, where it's by design meant to be transcendent, above any group or party line. So yeah, I think fundamentally it comes down to the policies and the ideas that you're willing to fight for.
We've talked about a number of issues in today's interview, but to wrap up this interview, why should voters elect you in New York's 10th congressional district? What's your closing message to voters out there?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much again, and congratulations to you. But the fundamental message is this. Again, we are in the midst of a global pandemic and the fourth industrial revolution, with economic projections worse than the Great Depression. More than 26 million Americans are unemployed. Nearly 50,000 are dead. Congress is still on recess. More than 1 million New Yorkers are unemployed. More than 10,000 have died in New York City, and Congress is still on recess. We need a representative who understands the structural crises we're facing and has a clear vision to tackle them. We need to wake up. So thank you so much.
Jonathan Herzog, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jonathan Herzog, who's running for Congress in New York's 10th congressional district. You can find out more about him on Twitter at JonathanHerzog5 or at Herzog2020.com. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about that interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe, or recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family. Until next time, goodbye.